So leaving multi-grade oil in an engine for a long period of time is something you got to be awfully careful with. It can get you in a lot of trouble. I've had that problem. As such, the last 20 years or so, I do not use multi-grade oil in my engines. I use 30-weight constant viscosity oil, winter, summer, spring, or fall. And for me, it works. Keeps the engine clean, and I have the ability to leave that oil in there for a longer period of time without creating engine damage. I know this is highly not recommended by the manufacturer. They think that during that first mile of driving, you're not getting any protection from the 30-weight oil. Only the multi-grade would do that for you. That engine heats up so fast, in such a short period of time in which it's running cold with whatever kind of oil you got in there, that the old days people used to put 20-weight oil in the winter and 30-weight oil in the summer into their automobile. Nowadays, with the way the engines are working and the power that the pump can create, the oil pump, 30-weight oil, to me, works very well. There are times when people have done service on my engine and the repair people will say, gee, must change your oil every 1,000 miles. It looks awfully clean. That's because it doesn't have the sludge buildup of the coagulant in its failure mode. Anyone with any further comments on this? I know this is controversial and a lot of people won't agree with me on this one, but I think there's too many disadvantages of multi-grade oil unless you're changing it at just the right interval, which is 3,000, 5,000 miles, something like that. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2OGB, the last thing I pretty much have for you is you do realize that as far as the engine coolant heating up faster than the oil, you do realize that the oil actually runs hotter than the coolant. Your coolant can be between anywhere from 195, 210, or 215. Keep in mind your oil could be between 245 to 250, but it'll start breaking down if it crosses over 275. That's why it can withstand higher heat, but it can't faster. That's the only disadvantage to it.
You had a couple of dropouts there and we missed some information, but at 275, you're saying the oil starts breaking down. I think it is the coagulant of multi-grade oil that's breaking down. 30-weight oil at 275 might not start breaking down, Craig. Go ahead, K2RIW.
Looked it up. A conventional motor oil usually sump temperatures at about up to 250, but it starts breaking down over 275. So you want to maintain it between 240 and 260. Your coolant on the plus side could be anywhere between 195 to 220 at the most.
When you talk about oil breaking down, is it the multi-grade oil, the coagulant that's breaking down, or do you believe the basic oil itself breaks down at those temperatures? And if it starts breaking down, what happens? Turning into some other kind of material? Is it turning black? Over to you, Craig, K2RIW.
Probably the oil itself could be breaking down because it gets thinner also as it gets hotter as well. That's another thing. You also got to realize as well. My car, just so you know, takes 0W20. The last oil change I had was a synthetic blend, so I have up to 3,000 miles. I pushed it up to 42 before I brought it in. And then before that, I had a full synthetic change, and then I went 5,000 before changing it.
I presume these synthetic oils are, 50% more expensive? Is that true?
Cost about 3 to 4 times as regular oil, but hey, you can go up to 75 or 10,000 miles or once a year with full synthetic oil. With regular non-synthetic, you're better off every 3 to 5,000 miles.
And once again, in my belief, what's going on for that recommended change time, we'll protect the coagulant, which can turn into sludge and start jamming up all kinds of channels inside the automobile. Once those channels become jammed up, you're subject to all kinds of crazy failures. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in with questions or comments. We're about to go over to Roy, who's got an interesting puzzle, among other things. Dr. Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW. Got it, Roy. Is Roy with us tonight, AC2GS, K2RIW? We're not hearing you right now, Roy.
continue on.
Could be here soon, Dick. I just spoke to him on the chat room.
How long ago did you talk to him in the chat room, Paul?
Oh, I don't know. 20 minutes, half hour ago. Something like that.
Hello, Roy. AC2GS.
Boom, you can hear me now?
Now we're hearing you, Roy. Up till now, we have not been hearing you. Have you been attempting to transmit to us?
Yeah. It's, the beauty of my system is it's very, very flexible. The downside is that if I randomly go anywhere near the wrong area and click, it screws things up. So I was off frequency for a couple of minutes, so I'm back on.
Out of curiosity, what frequency did you hop to, Roy? Go ahead.
Don't know, but it was probably an illegal one because my transmitter wouldn't operate the push-to-talk button. And then I noticed that the 850 wasn't selected as the transmission frequency, and I just clicked it back on and said hello.
Okay, all's well and you sound good. Please proceed.
Okay, very good. As always, I like to remind people, it's very rare to have a mailbag question, but, you know, John used to have loads of them. So if anyone out there can hear us, and as always, I stream the audio through technet.ac2gs.com, and also the EchoLink feed gives you audio, but if you can't get in for whatever reason to ask Dick a question, you can address it to me via the mailbag, and I'll relay it to Dick. If you have any questions or topics for Paul, or you want him to read an article and comment upon it, you can email me that information. And if you have any topics you'd like me to discuss, or if you have any puzzlers, because those are the things that I find very hard to find, please, the email address is mailbag at ac2s.com. Again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. And as always, everything that I talk about, I will put up links so you can read the original articles that they're based on. The link page is new for 2020, although you can go back to the 2019 and the 2018 pages. But all you have to do is type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you to the link page. So with that, let me drop for a second, and I'll give you my little mini puzzler for this week. Okay, I'll give you a little information before I ask you a question. Dinosaurs have always fascinated me. I'm sure they fascinated many of you, and most of you have taken the time to go to the Museum of Natural History and seen all those great skeletons and such. So I was kind of interested in dinosaurs for this week, and I looked up to see what the largest dinosaur known to man is. And apparently, it's a very curious story. Apparently, in 1987, a farmer in Argentina dug up this thing that he thought was a petrified a tree about the size of a full-grown human being. Later on, they figured out it wasn't a tree, it was a vertebra of a particular dinosaur. So they named it Argentosaurus. It's a member of the sauropod family, which are known to be rather big. They're also known to be herbivores. They theorized that this particular dinosaur might have grown to as long as 131 feet long and been as much as 110 tons of weight. So that's probably the largest dinosaur that at least science knows. So for tonight's little question, and some people will like it, and probably others will have semantic arguments with me, but that's part of the fun. Tonight's puzzle is, what is the smallest known dinosaur?
I'm going to guess a hummingbird. Over to you, Roy.
You're too clever for me, Dick. Yes, indeed, it is the hummingbird. The smallest hummingbird is known as a bee hummingbird. It's found in basically in Cuba and no place else. It's about 2 inches long, and it weighs less than 700ths of an ounce, or 2 grams. And as I was always fascinated to find out that the modern-day birds evolved from
the ancient dinosaurs. Many dinosaurs were warm-blooded. That was kind of discovered in my lifetime. And it was another surprise when they figured out that some dinosaurs had feathers covering them. So yes, indeed, if you want to extrapolate that birds are simply overgrown dinosaurs, the hummingbird is the smallest known dinosaur. Gold star to you, Dick.
I'm amazed that was the correct answer. That poor little hummingbird, I think you said 0.07 ounce. Wow. Can you imagine how fast his wings are moving? Because the way aerodynamics work, as you make the wings smaller and smaller, it's got to move faster and faster in order to still create lift. Can you imagine the rate of his heart when he's doing this flying and maneuvering? And my guess is he must be continuously consuming food every 20 minutes in order to sustain that rate of metabolism. How in the world does the poor thing sleep at nighttime? And being that small, his thermal time constant is extremely small, so therefore he can't tolerate cold weather, in my opinion. That must be a warm weather bird. AC2GS, K2RIW, with a bunch of guesses.
I would agree with you. This particular species of hummingbird only lives in Cuba, which is a rather warm climate, fortunately for it. It's one of those flying objects where people tell each other that according to science they shouldn't be flying, but that's just kind of a limited understanding of what science is and such. They don't fly by the simpler methods that we use for planes. Although, I don't know if you read it, but a couple of weeks ago, Scientific American did yet another article on how we don't fully understand how airplanes stay up in the air. Did you read that one, Dick?
I sure did, and I think they made a lot more mystery about it than they had to. There's a number of respected articles by people with aerodynamic PhDs and all kinds of patents that explain that Bernoulli's principle is always taught as what creates the lift of a wing, and very few people actually carry out the Bernoulli calculation. When you do find out in order to create the amount of lift that, say, for instance, a Cessna 150 needs, or a Piper J3, or any of these more popular, older aircraft, to create the lift by pure Bernoulli's principle, the wing would have to be two or three times fatter in the center than it is. There'd have to be a hell of a lot more curvature. The majority of lift of any wing really is much more Newton than Bernoulli. The main function of a wing when you're flying is to deflect air downward. Air has a significant amount of mass, and when you deflect air downward because of the angle of attack of the wing, action and reaction gives you what we call lift. So it's not such a mystery for certain articles that I could bring to your attention. And why Scientific American made it into such a mystery is a little bit mysterious to me. You ask the average engineer, what is the mass of 1 cubic meter of air, the stuff that's in the room with you right now? And many an engineer will guess a milligram. The air in the room with you right now, a cubic meter of it, is 1.2 kilograms, 2.7 pounds. Air is heavy stuff. You've got a life experience, that confirms that. Remember the first time as a child at 40 miles an hour, you stuck your hand out the window of the car and aim the hand in various directions. You remember the force of that wind on your hand, giving you a strong clue that the air is pretty heavy stuff. Under many circumstances, it moves out of the way so easily you get fooled into thinking it's a very light substance. It's not. A fuel air bomb is very destructive. What's happening to those soldiers in Iran, was it Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever they were, and the Iran rockets were aimed toward them. The blast of those rockets created brain injuries on quite a number of those students, soldiers. That was a shockwave in air that did it. Pretty heavy stuff can do a lot of damage. The main blast you get from an atomic bomb is that you've drastically heated the local air, it expanded rapidly, and that shockwave in air is what's doing most of the damage. You explode an atomic bomb in the vacuum of space, and it's an extremely different event. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I agree. It was the bombing was the Iranians bombed the Iraqi bases of the American armed forces. So that's how that injury happened. And I take even Scientific American with a little bit of a grain of salt. You have to understand that it's a science popularizing magazine, so they tend to kind of promote hot topics or mysteries to be solved and such. And, you know, there's the regular article about dark matter, dark energy, and no one has a clue what it is still, but that doesn't stop articles being generated. So I found it an engaging article, and, you know, I always suggest that people invest, buy a magazine. They're dying things. Popular Science is down to a quarterly magazine, and I would hate to have something like Scientific American follow suit. So please, if you're interested in these types of subjects, and I would assume you are because you listen to me babble on, consider, you know, getting a subscription to Scientific American. It's generally a very well-written magazine. Just wanted to add, because I was expecting someone to kind of get in my face and say, birds are not dinosaurs, birds are birds. So I had a small list of relatively diminutive fossilized dinosaurs. There was in the Mongolian desert, Gobi Desert, back in 2007, they found a 2-foot-long dinosaur called a Mahakala Amnagove, which they say lived about 80 million years ago. Also, there was something called a Yai Kwai, a feathered dinosaur from China with the membranous wings like bats. It had a wingspan of about 23 inches, and it weighed about 13 ounces. So those are some of the diminutive fossilized dinosaurs. I'm sure if there was a dinosaur that weighed 0.07 grams, I don't think it could survive the 80 million odd years of fossilization. So that's probably why we're not seeing anything smaller than these particular fossils. So if anyone has any questions about this particular topic, or they have any science questions or topics that they'd like to bring up before I drop into my semi-depressing stories about scientific news, please feel free.
By the way, the first time you told us about the small bee hummingbird, you called it 0.07 ounce. The last time you mentioned it, you said 0.07 gram. I'm having a little trouble believing the bird could be that light. Over to you, Roy.
Sorry, I misspoke. It was 2 grams or 0.07 ounces. Yeah, so it was 2 grams. Sorry. Let's move on to the other stories, and I hope I'm not depressing people by talking about the coronavirus, but I think it's a big thing to kind of know about, so I have a couple of little stories about it. The United States, Australia, and New Zealand are temporarily denying entry to non-citizens who've recently traveled to China, hoping to limit the spread of the new coronavirus to their countries. While Japan will bar foreigners who have been in Chinese provinces at the center of the outbreak, the American restrictions announced over the past few days exempt immediate family members of American citizens and permanent residents. Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced Australia's temporary ban on Saturday, saying that Australian citizens, Australian residents, dependents, legals, and guardians or spouses would still be allowed into the country. American officials also said that any United States citizen returning home who has been in the Hubei province of China within the past 14 days, believed to be the virus's incubation period, will be quarantined for up to 14 days. Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, is in Hubei. Those who have been to other parts of China within the past 14 days will be subject to proactive entry screening and up to 14 days monitoring and self-quarantining. Overall, nearly 10,000 flights have been canceled since the outbreak, according to Cirium, the global travel and data analytics company. Vietnam barred almost all flights from and to mainland mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau until May 1st, according to the United States Federal Aviation Administration. Only flights that have received approval from Vietnam Civil Aviation Authority will be allowed during the ban, which took effect this Saturday. Four airlines in the Philippines announced they were reducing or canceling flights to China: Cebu Pacific Air, Philippines Airlines, Philippines AirAsia, and the local unit of AirAsia Group, the Reuters news agency reported. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said that the country would bar entry to foreigners who had visited Hubei within the past 14 days or who had passports issued in Hubei. Let me drop for a second. Taiwan is barring Chinese nationals from the southern coastal province of Guangdong from entry beginning Saturday, and travelers who recently visited the area will be subject to a mandatory 14-day quarantine, Taiwan state media said on Saturday. The United States will also funnel all flights from China to just a few airports, including Kennedy in New York, O'Hare in Chicago, and San Francisco International Airport. Several countries were evacuating their citizens from Hubei. South Korea, India, and Bangladesh have flown hundreds of their citizens home from Wuhan, while Indonesia and Turkey have sent planes there, according to the Associated Press report. On Monday, the Russian military will begin evacuating Russians from affected regions in China, Russian media reported. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, said that the American actions were being taken because there are a lot of unknowns surrounding the virus and its transmission path. The announcement came as a major air carrier suspended flights between the United States and mainland China. American Airlines, Delta Airlines, and United Airlines said direct air service would be halted for months, news that rattled the stock market and industries that depend upon the flow of goods and people. Qantas followed suit on Saturday, announcing its own suspension of flights to China. Turkmenistan Airlines began an indefinite suspension of flights to Beijing from Saturday because of the outbreak, according to a statement. Qatar Airlines also suspended flights to China. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GF. Okay, here's part two. This is a multi-part story, I'm afraid. China is now dealing with another disease outbreak, this one mostly affecting animals, but also potentially deadly among people. The Ministry of Agriculture said late Saturday that a fresh outbreak of a lethal form of influenza had been found in poultry in the southern province of Hunan, and that officials had ordered the slaughter of 17,828 chickens. China had previously dealt with several bird flu outbreaks, the most recent in April 2019. In the new case, the H5N1 bird flu virus was found in a farm in the city of Shaoyang. The farm had 7,850 chickens, and more than half died from bird flu. The ministry said it called the strain highly pathogenic. It is very bad. Although bird flu poses more of a danger to poultry than humans, it is not easily transmissible among people. The World Health Organization has called on countries to be on guard because the virus can mutate into a transmissible form and has the potential to cause a pandemic. The latest outbreak comes as China grapples with an African swine fever epidemic that has infected tens of thousands of pigs. It could stoke more worries among its people about the country's food supply. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX. Okay, on to the next part. The Chinese government has delivered on its promise to build a hospital for coronavirus patients at the epicenter of the outbreak within 10 days. About 1,400 military medics will begin working at the hospital on Monday, according to state news media. Several state outlets streamed footage from the new hospital, whose name, Wu Shenshan, translates to Fire Guard Mountain. The building in the city of Wuhan stands roughly 365,000 square feet and has been fitted with 1,000 beds. Another specialty hospital that is due to have 1,500 beds is also being constructed in Wuhan. That hospital, whose name is Len Chen Shan, translates to Thunder God Mountain and is expected to be completed this following week. Since the coronavirus emerged, public anger has boiled, with many criticizing officials for failing to stem the outbreak during a peak travel season. Hospitals in Wuhan have been met with a shortage of masks and basic protective gear for their doctors and their nurses, prompting online pleas for greater supplies. The new hospitals are intended to relieve some pressure on Wuhan's overwhelmed previous hospitals, which have turned away many people with flu symptoms, as the number of coronavirus patients and suspected cases has rapidly grown. This is not the first time China has mobilized its large resources to complete in days what would take months to build elsewhere. During the SARS epidemic of 2003, Peking built a hospital with similar speed. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, what's the total number of people who have this virus today in all countries? And it seems to be expanding at an awful fast rate. What number of victims, or at least those catching the disease, are required before you stop calling it an epidemic and call it a pandemic? Where's the threshold there, Roy? K2RIW?
The way things go, there are epidemics, there are pandemics. Pandemics are also based upon geographical location. So you can have an epidemic in one continent, and it stays an epidemic by definition. If you demonstrate an epidemic in more than one continent, which is probably going to happen real soon now, that's when it gets the nomenclature of pandemic.
Calling you up.
WB2, America Hotel Kilo.
Yes, America Hotel Kilo.
Question. Let's say it comes to New York and it's all over the place. If somebody in the, say, the food service business touches food, let's just say simple things like someplace in a milk end or a bread, staples of life, if they have the flu, could it get into that food? And if we went to the supermarket, could we get the flu from buying, going into a supermarket and buying that food? Go ahead.
It's transferred by bodily fluids, spittle and what have you. Theoretically, depending upon the storage and the time period between, to a degree, yes, unfortunately. I think most contacts are going to be, tend to be person to person. Most likely, you know, you go into a large crowded room or a store or something where someone's coughing someplace and the air conditioning is going to circulate that air all over the place. But it's worrisome. And to get back for a short second about something that Dick mentioned, according to what I read, and it changes about every hour, unfortunately, there's about 300 people who've died, mostly in China, and there's at least 14,000 cases, and some people think that China's been kind of light on the numbers, and it's probably more like 100,000. So, you know, it's kind of, it's up for arguments of how accurate China wants to be. China has a weird tendency to downplay a lot of things, whereas in the United States, something like 30,000-40,000 people died of influenza last year. That's the usual death rate. China, I think, listed something like 95 in that enormous country. So I tend to not believe their numbers.
WB2HK, one more time. Let me see if I have it. All right. So what do you think of the effectiveness of wearing a paper mask? Is it worthless in your mind? And could this virus, if somebody sneezes nearby you and you were wearing a paper mask over your nose, but your eyes can't be covered, would that flu get right to your eyes and into your body that way? Over.
Now, this is a coronavirus. This is not influenza. It's a slightly different type of virus. Any exposed area. Masks, I guess, are relatively non-risky, low-price slight benefit. It's better than nothing, maybe, but it's not a heck of a lot. I mean, don't put on a mask and think that you could walk in the middle of a clinic that has a whole bunch of people coughing at each other and walk away completely sterile. But it's better than nothing. Unfortunately, you know, people I've heard are just buying up all the damn masks. So it's probably going to have a run on that very, very soon. I'm sure in China it's impossible to get actual masks. They are recycling masks, whatever that quite means. So it's better than nothing is the bottom line, unfortunately.
Wow, Dr. Roy. Bad, very scary. In my job, I work in the school system, actually a school bus driver, that's my retired job. And every day, all the time, kids are sneezing and coughing all the time. I deal with very young children from kindergarten up, and it's constant. And other bus drivers and my wife and I, who also works in the school bus department, we are always coming down with upper respiratory problems and colds and stuff. And I hate to say it, but we call the children breeders. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I agree with you. Not only do they not maintain the most sterile technologies, but and they share it with each other and with anyone around. They're basically little petri dishes, unfortunately. Influenza is probably a much better design for its own purposes, infectious process. It tends to not kill a large number of people, and it's able to mutate and modify itself so that it's not recognized by our immune system every year's cycle. So it's kind of like the ultimate, if it was a little bit more benign, it would be kind of the ultimate a viral organism that just replicates itself without screwing things up too much. You know, smallpox and such wasn't that effective because it tended to kill people around it so much that it isolated it and it finally, hopefully, for the most part, died out. This particular variation of coronavirus looks like it's going to be a little bit different than its sister SARS from 2003. It seems to be more infectious than SARS was, which is not a good thing at all. They're kind of difficult to pin down how deadly it is. As I mentioned earlier, we kind of take influenza as something that just happens. But unfortunately, 80,000 Americans died of complications due to influenza. And that's a very destructive virus. Hopefully, this coronavirus won't go anywhere near that. But I think it's going to have an impact. It certainly is going to have an economic impact and an environmental impact. I hope it doesn't get much worse. But chances are it's going to get worse before it gets better.
All right, Dr. Roy, thank you. I could just see New York City with its trains, and people might have it on the trains and stations and coming in on the planes. Whenever you're in an area, contained area with somebody that's sick, and you have a blower system, the air conditioning system, it can be, the air will be moved around the object that you're in, the vessel, that multiplied. All right, thank you very much, Dr. Roy. I appreciate that. I listen all the time, and I love listening to you, and it's always good to hear what you have to say. Thank you, WB2A.
Okay, thanks a lot. I just hope that I'm not depressing people too much. I have a few more news items on coronavirus, and then hopefully we'll bounce out of it into something a little bit less dire. A patient at a hospital in New York City may have the novel coronavirus. City health officials announced this Saturday, if confirmed, it would be the first reported instance of the virus in this city. Local authorities are sending a sample to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention because they're unable to test for the virus. They're taking it very seriously because the patient has troublesome symptoms. and a history, a travel history from China, because the patient tested negative for influenza and other common illnesses. Health authorities said that the individual who is being treated at Bellevue Hospital Center is under 40 years of age and is in stable condition. They said they do not expect to receive the results from the CDC for 36 to 48 hours or possibly even longer. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, the first case of coronavirus in Massachusetts has been confirmed. Officials said on Saturday that a man in his 20s who returned from Wuhan and lives in Boston, bringing the total number of confirmed cases in the United States up to 8 at that time. The University of Massachusetts Boston confirmed in a separate statement on Saturday that a member of the school's community had contracted the virus. The statement also said that it expected business as usual on that campus. The authorities in Massachusetts were notified by the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention of the positive test results late Friday evening, according to a statement by the Boston Public Health Commission. The man recently traveled to Wuhan and sought medical care soon after his return to Massachusetts, the statement said. He will remain in isolation until he is cleared by public health officials, and his close contacts are being monitored. Monica Beray, the Massachusetts Public Health Commissioner, said in a statement that she was grateful that the man is recovering and sought medical attention immediately. Massachusetts has been preparing for a possible case of this new coronavirus, she said, and we were fortunate that astute clinicians took appropriate actions quickly. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Boy, do you know how do they test for this? How do they clear people? You know, the guy gets off the plane and they're not sure if he's got it or not. Or they do just watch him for 2 weeks, or, you know, they take their blood every day. Or is it the blood test that they look through a microscope and they say, okay, you got it or you don't? How do they confirm that?
I mean, there's two levels. I mean, unfortunately, at airports, they're just pointing these infrared thermometers at people's forehead and hoping for the best, but all that tells you is if the person has a fever. But the influenza, and unfortunately, since this particular virus can have as long as a 14-day quiet stage, it could just be waiting to explode. The definitive tests are serology tests of the virus, antibodies that are specifically designed to fight the coronavirus. And right now, as far as the United States is concerned, the CDC has the only supply of those. So what it amounts to is if you have someone highly suspicious who doesn't test positive for serology, for influenza or other things, they send a couple of tubes down to the CDC and they do some tests. As I mentioned before, it can take 4 or 5 days to get the serology. The coronaviruses are, as most viruses, are very, very small. It's very, very difficult to concentrate them, and you would need an electron microscope to actually see the detail of things like that. So it's primarily a reaction to antibodies from immune reactions.
Okay, very good. I guess this is the CDC. This is the group that they cut all the funding for, I think, a year or so ago. I can't be good. I think they're going to have to raise the funding if that's true.
I would agree. It's not good. They've basically been cutting the funding for just about everything in the federal government, except maybe missile launchers and aircraft carriers. I don't know. But yes, they've cut back the CDC. The CDC is our bulwark against infectious diseases. They have some very brilliant people. They have some very expensive equipment. They're the guys who store the smallpox viruses and all the terrible things just in case we need to do tests on them. So you wanna pay these people. You don't wanna shut them down. So yeah, I think they're gonna have to throw a couple of bucks at the CDC at the end of this, or maybe even better right now.
Yeah, Roy, especially if that's the group that's the only group that could test this stuff. I think that's the group that they weren't there like hundreds of scientists they got rid of? They said they had to move to Kansas or something. The group that they got rid of.
Well, thankfully, that unfortunately was the Agriculture Department, which had a very large scientific branch that unfortunately tended to publish things that were politically incorrect, I guess. And so they had this brilliant idea. They couldn't quite fire them because they're civil servants. So they simply told them that, by the way, they have to move 1,000 miles away in about a week and a half. And if you don't like it, you can quit. I never quite figured out exactly how many people moved to, you know, Nebraska or wherever the hell they planted them and how many quit. But the government's kind of in a whole bunch of problems right now. One of the things is that there's a lot of positions that are unfilled, and I don't know if they're planning to fill them. It's good to have smart people in the government.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that. I have my different agencies mixed up. Okay. Well, okay. It sounds like they cut them, but it wasn't that group. I'm glad it wasn't that group. I hope they have some people there. You know, if they're going to start testing millions of people and you only got one group that could do it, wow. You know, I thought this was maybe, you know, a blood test that, you know, they were going to send to Quest Labs and say, yeah, okay, you got it, but it doesn't sound like that. I'll let you continue on, Roy. AC2GFWS2F.
Okay, very good, Paul. Yeah, I mean, eventually, I am sure the CDC will join with some laboratory companies and set up facilities in local regions so that it will expedite these tests in a more timely manner. But they're just starting up because, you know, we're just popping up with people to test in the United States. Up until a week or so ago, we didn't have anyone, so there wasn't much cause for an industry to bring it into existence. Let me drop, and I will do my last, I promise, the Wuhan coronavirus story for this particular week. Okay, dope. As a newly discovered pneumonia-causing virus threatens to engulf China and spread far beyond its borders, governments and researchers are scrambling to create a preventive vaccine. But will it arrive too late to help people? And is it possible that we missed having a head start on its development? The reported toll of the 2019 nCoV, more plainly known as the Wuhan virus, after the city where it was discovered last December, continues to climb. As of early January 27th, there have been nearly 14,000 reported cases of the virus, along with 300 deaths, predominantly in China. But some epidemiological studies have suggested that the true number might be as high as 100,000. So far, the epicenter remains in China, where several cities have been essentially quarantined to prevent further transmission. Cases have also been identified in more than a dozen areas outside of mainland China, including 5 in the United States. These cases have largely involved people who caught the virus in China, then traveled elsewhere, but some public health researchers are warning that it may already be too late to contain the outbreak within China. While governments are taking steps to physically prevent the virus from spreading further, such as through airport screenings, the United States and China have also announced plans to develop a vaccine, as have research teams in other countries. It's not the first time in recent years that scientists have been tasked with creating a vaccine for an emerging disease that's erupted into massive outbreaks. 2014 saw the largest ever outbreak of Ebola virus, while the Zika virus spread widely throughout the Americas in 2016. These efforts weren't fast enough to pay off significantly during the actual crisis. There's now an approved, highly effective vaccine for Ebola, which has helped during the ongoing outbreak that began last year, but saw limited action during the 2014 outbreak. Potential Zika vaccines remain experimental. We're already working on it, and hopefully in a period of about 3 months, we'll be able to start a phase one trial in humans. Anthony Fucci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease at the National Institute of Health, told Bloomberg News last week.
By as soon as this summer, assuming things go well, we could start to see successful vaccine candidates deployed on an experimental basis in the real world. Let me drop for a sec. If anyone is able to pull off such a feat, it would undoubtedly be the fastest time between discovering a new disease and finding a way to vaccinate ourselves against it. And it would reflect the speed with which the global research community has banded together against the common foe. Within days of the first documented 2019 nCoV case in China, researchers in the country unpacked the genetic blueprint of the virus, and more importantly, they shared it with the rest of the world. That transparency allowed researchers everywhere to quickly study the ins and outs of this virus and to start trying to create a vaccine for it. By the second week of January, Science Magazine reported on Monday, the NIH had entered a contract with the biotech firm Moderna to start work on a Wuhan coronavirus vaccine. Last week, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation announced it was funding three teams, including Moderna, to create their version of a vaccine. At the same time, the race is an example of the often reactive nature of vaccine development, according to Peter Hotsu, a dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. Quote, we have a broken system for two types of vaccines. One is vaccines for potentially pandemic diseases like Ebola or SARS, and the other are vaccines for neglected tropical diseases, he told reporters. And that's because neither of these vaccines tend to make that much money. Hotez and his team have been working for years on vaccines against a virus closely related to 2019 nCoV, the virus that causes SARS. In trials with mice, the team's vaccines appear highly effective at preventing any sign of lasting infection or illness from SARS. By 2017, they published research showing that they could easily and safely mass-produce the vaccine using yeast. Grow it. But that turned out to be their crescendo. Their work had largely been funded by the United States government through the National Institute of Health, and the government declined to give them the money they'd need to pursue further studies in humans. Let me drop for a sec. Practically, a SARS vaccine might have seemed unnecessary at the time. In 2002, SARS erupted on the world stage as it sickened more than 8,000 people and killed nearly 800, also mostly in China, over a six-month span. But SARS hasn't been seen in humans since July 2003, and that strain of the virus has likely gone extinct. As this current outbreak has shown, though, there are plenty of other coronaviruses out there capable of jumping the species barrier to people, as SARS did. In a world that prioritizes the proactive development of vaccines, Hotez said, we might have been much better prepared for Wuhan. That was one of the major frustrations we had, he said. Once SARS was gone, nobody wanted to invest in a SARS vaccine. So for the last 3-4 years, it sat there in the freezer, Hotez said. If we had more anticipatory systems, that vaccines would have gone through all the safety testing needed and potentially would have been ready to roll into human trials right from the start. Still, Hotez and his team's work may not have gone to waste. Scientists have shown that the Wuhan virus is very genetically similar to SARS. That closeness should hopefully make a vaccine intended for SARS relatively easy to modify for Wuhan. Hotez said he's been in talks with the NIH and other federal agencies to reboot his team's research, and he believes that they could start work immediately if they got the go-ahead. With practical results, such as knowing how safe their vaccine is to use in people, not too far behind. Quote, potentially, if we move forward now and the stars align, we're talking weeks and months until clinical research could advance to the point where we're collecting patient safety information, he said. Let me drop any questions or comments. This is AC2GF. Okay, that's it for Wuhan this week. Most of the other stories are much nicer. The FCC just gave Google, Sony, and two other companies the green light to open the 3.5 gigahertz band to commercial use. Considered by many as a building block for the 5G network, the 3.5 gigahertz band could speed up 4G communications and enhance 5G networks, helping the latest iPhones and Android devices reach faster data speeds in the United States. The FCC named Google, Sony, CommScope, and the Federated Wireless Incorporated Spectrum Access system administrators, they're now authorized to make a slice of 3.5 gigahertz band available for commercial purposes, meaning the private sector should finally have access to the mid-range spectrum for the 5G network. Quote, the FCC has made it a priority to free up mid-band spectrum for advanced wireless services like 5G, and today I'm pleased to announce the latest step to achieve that priority, the approval of four systems that will enable the 3.5 gigahertz band to be put to use for the benefit of American consumers and businesses, said FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. This has been a long time coming. The FCC voted up to free up a piece of the 3.5 gigahertz spectrum in 2015, but multiple disputes delayed the effort. Previously, the band was used by the United States Naval Radar System. The Navy didn't use the entire spectrum at all times, but the FCC had to sort out how to make room for both the Navy and commercial players. At this point, most people see opening the 3.5 gigahertz spectrum as overdue. 5G networks in Europe and the Middle East and Asia already have access to the mid-range band. Hopefully, with these four companies free to move forward as SAS administrators, we'll see the 3.5 gigahertz spectrum put to use in the United States soon. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, there's a couple of things about this. I think as amateur radio operators, we have to realize that a lot of these wireless providers are licking their spectral chops as they look at various amateur frequencies that we have up in the microwave range and just waiting to move in.
I agree with you, John. The Congress has discovered that they can privatize the frequencies and sell them off and make a lot of money. So I'm expecting more of that rather than less, unfortunately. The only thing keeping them from selling off a lot of our frequencies is maybe they don't want to hear too many people yell and scream at them. But eventually, when these companies show them their checkbooks, one of these days we're going to have a lot of problems with the microwave. Thankfully, these people aren't really interested in the HF band or even UHF and VHF, but they're really gunning for pretty much every bit of the microwave band.
Yeah, and the sad thing about it is that a lot of the fascinating research that's done by amateur radio operators takes place in microwave bands. Other types of high-frequency, ultra-high-frequency use have records that are set up 90 gigahertz, where a lot of good amateur radio research.
I would agree. I mean, there's these little pockets of innovation among amateur radio operators. A lot of us just like to gab on the radio. There are people doing very interesting work with very low frequencies. There are other people doing excellent work with microwave. There's all kinds of things going on at the edges. So the problem, as I see it, is that our community, our hobby, is kind of demographically getting older and older and older and fading rather fast. And there's this onslaught of guys with a lot of money willing to show Congress that they're willing to pay for stuff. So it becomes a tipping point of when there aren't enough people crying out havoc when they try and sell the frequencies out from under us. Unfortunately, it would be nice if we lived in a world where you just showed them the evidence and they said, okay, fine. I think you have to show voters that would vote against them or something. So, I don't know. I'm not terribly optimistic about our microwave band. I tend to think that eventually it's going to come to a tipping point, but maybe I've just been depressed by all these damn Wuhan stories I've been saying.
And also, the current political climate doesn't help any, but I know the political net.
It's right after the philosophy net and before the religion net. Anyway, on with the next story. Though it's the nearest star to Earth, the sun is still a mystery, and understanding its behavior specifically the behaviors that manifest in space weather here on Earth, has proven difficult. The Inouye Solar Telescope Core goals include imaging the sun's magnetic field in greater detail than ever before. On Earth, we can predict if it's going to rain pretty much anywhere in the world very accurately, and space weather just isn't there yet, said Matt Mountain, president of the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy, which manages the Inouye Solar Telescope. He said that in a press conference. The Inouye Solar Telescope is meant to improve space weather prediction. The telescope in Halakaha, Maui in Hawaii, relies on a 4-meter mirror, the largest yet for solar telescopes, and requires an advanced cooling system to prevent overheating from focusing all of that sunlight. Optics remove distortions from the atmosphere, while a dome temperature controls the area around the telescope, and a component called the heat stop filter filters out excess energy. The first image and video released this past week shows gas circulating around the sun. Heat brings the gas to the surface at the bright center of each cell, which then spreads out and descends back beneath the surface at the dark line. Each cell is approximately the size of Texas, according to the National Solar Observatory press release. The movie, on a linked website that I'll have listed, shows the process occurring over 10 minutes. Like other telescopes on the Hawaii island, the Inouye Solar Telescope was met with resistance from local Hawaiians, as the site on which it sits is considered sacred ground. Science reports that the circumstances surrounding the Inouye Solar Telescope differ slightly from the controversial 30-meter telescope. For example, it's much smaller, and much of Inouye's solar telescope construction progress has been done privately, and the military-guarded national park atop Alakaya made it more difficult for protesters to access it. This image won't be used for scientific research. The team will still be testing and calibrating the telescope over the next 6 months. After that, researchers will combine Inouye's solar telescope data with the data from NASA's Parker Solar Probe and the upcoming European Space Agency NASA Solar Orbiter to paint a fuller picture of how the sun works. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm glad they named it after that guy, Daniel Inouye, senator from Hawaii. Now he's, you know, he's passed on, but he's one of the good guys. You know, went through World War II and all. Back to you.
Yes, I remember him doing interviews in the Senate, you know, back in the good old days. I believe he got his arm shot off because I have this vague memory of a sleeve that was draped whenever he was having an interview. But yeah, he's one of those relatively good guys. You know, some people make it to statesmen and some not so much. And Daniel Inouye was one of those guys. Inouye, I would assume, would be he's Japanese origin. There's a lot of Japanese people who moved and live in Hawaii.
Yeah, very good. I didn't know about that telescope until I read your email. So that's very good. Now I looked up a picture of the telescope. You could see it looking at the sun, and it looks like it's got all these radiators, and I guess to try to get rid of the heat, like you said, but sounds good. Between that, Parker, and then the one I'm going to talk about, the solar probe, that's going to be launched next week, they're going to get more information about the sun than they know what to do with.
Indeed, and I'm always for more information. There's nothing wrong with learning more about something, and so I'm hoping that everything goes to plan. Again, if anyone is interested, and you think that they would be if they're listening to me babble on, I will have a link to this particular article that has some very nice pictures and a movie of what the telescope has picked up so far. And it's a high resolution, and it's a very pretty bunch of pictures. So please, after Paul is done with the space report, go to roy.acts.com and click the link and take a look at what the sun looks like from a different perspective. Okay, on to the next. We're all a little Neanderthal, or Neanderthal, if you want to pronounce it correctly. That's the conclusion of a study that used a new statistical technique to